This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another Joy 94.9 podcast.
Good evening and welcome to Well, Well, Well. This is Tex McKenzie from the Victorian AIDS Council Gay Men's Health Centre with you tonight. I'm flying solo. Kylie is in Geelong at a conference and Jason is away on leave in Canada. But I do have the wonderful Travis pushing all the buttons and levers, making sure that you can hear me tonight. So thank you to Travis. And also thanks to Doug and the Rainbow Report team. They're having quite a riotous celebration for the end of the Rainbow Report outside the studio right now. And next time they clap and applaud, you may even hear them through the microphone. As I said, it's Tex McKenzie from the Health Promotion Program at the Victorian AIDS Council Gay Men's Health Centre. First off tonight, I'd like to thank everyone who joined up or renewed their memberships during the Alphabet Soup Radiothon last week, and to those generous folk who also made donations to the station. I'd like to welcome you to the Joy family and say it's great to have you on board. Of course, you can still go in the draw for the specialist and major prizes by ringing 96992949 up until the 20th of July. On the show tonight, we have an interview which was pre-recorded 2 weeks ago by Kylie and myself with Stephen Robinson. He's a specialist in men's health from the United Kingdom. Plus, if we've got time, we'll have a few snippets of information about events happening around town. If you'd like to send us a message or call, you can send us an SMS via 0427 Joy 949, or if you've got your fingers hovering over the keyboard, you could send us an email onair@joy.org.au, or to speak with someone on the phone, especially if you want to become a member, 96992949. This is Well, Well, Well on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for joining us today. You've got a pretty busy schedule. You've just arrived in Australia, 2 days ago?
Yep. So bit jet-lagged still.
Yes.
But smiling.
And you've come to the beautiful cold. Although you might be used to that from...
I'm afraid so.
Yes.
Yeah, it's home from home.
Coming from Leeds. Now, you are a reader in men's health at the Centre for Men's Health at Leeds Metropolitan University. What exactly is a reader?
A reader is someone who works in research, and usually someone in terms of the career ladder, someone who's been working in research for quite a number of years. So there's various research positions that you move up through, research assistant, associate, fellow, senior fellow, then reader, then professor, is a fairly typical career path.
So you're one step away from... professor.
Yeah, so people tell me, which is quite frightening.
How much work is involved to actually get to professor then?
It all depends. There's you usually have to apply internally, and serious large committees look at mainly things like how much money you've brought in grant applications, how many publications you've got out, and the quality of publications, and then they'll say whether or not you are fit to be a professor.
Now, you here in Australia too, you've presented in Melbourne, and you're going to be presenting in the Gold Coast to talk about the area of men's health.
Yeah.
Now, you haven't always worked in men's health. What were you doing before for working in this area?
I started off many years ago training to be a nurse, and worked in nursing for quite a long time, mainly the very sort of blokey end of nursing. Intensive care, coronary care, cardiac surgery, sort of areas that blokes typically drift towards. And then went off to do a degree and ended up, by default, doing a degree partly in health studies, which was much more sociological, and it was very different to anything that I'd experienced. I was quite scientific by background originally. So I began to think about health in a much wider sense, and that led me into... then doing some additional training to become what we call in the UK a health visitor. And health visitors are, they call themselves family visitors. They get involved with families that have new babies when the baby's about 10 to 14 days old. And they visit then intermittently until that child starts school at around about 5 years old. more in the early weeks and months, less as time goes on, but they still have input with that family until the child starts school at five.
Okay. And although it's a family visitor, is it? Are you more involved with the mother and the child?
Yeah, I think I was tricked into going into health visiting. I was led to believe it was much more health promotion, public health focused. But what I found when I started doing it is it was very much mother and child oriented in practice. So there's a bit of a discrepancy between what health visiting says it is, which is, you know, they see themselves as public health nurses. Like I say, they see themselves as working with whole families. But in practice, the focus is very much still mother and baby.
Steve, does that mean that these visits are conducted when the father isn't around? The father is at work. I mean, traditionally, in the traditional mould, the father will be working, the mother's at home with the child. Is that the reason why men weren't involved or aren't involved? Is it because they're not there at the time?
Yeah, I think a lot of nurses enjoy moving into health visiting because it is a 9-to-5 job. It's one of the few areas of nursing that is a 9-to-5 task rather than working shifts. But yeah, what that means is exactly what you say, that often the dads aren't around. They're typically around, I found, at the first visit. We used to be obliged to make the first visit at 10-to-4 when the baby was 10 to 14 days old, and that was for a particular blood test that you would do on the child at that time. And quite often the dads would be around at that visit, but not always at subsequent visits. And it was always of interest to me why didn't health visitors do shift work? You know, why couldn't they work in evenings? And indeed, some set up fathers' groups in pubs that happened of an evening. And so there were some models that moved what health visiting was, but few and far between.
So did that then spark your interest in looking at working with men and some of the challenges you've raised, some of them, but a lot of the other challenges about working with men?
Yeah, very much so. My movement into health visiting happened at the same time as my partner at the time did her degree in women's studies and politics and became very interested in feminist issues. So I had this situation at work where I was working predominantly with female colleagues and clients, which was quite different to my days in intensive care, where a lot of my colleagues and obviously a lot of the clients were men. So I had that situation at work, and then a situation at home where there was interesting challenges in terms of, I guess, what academics call the division of labour, but what I think of as, you know, who takes out the rubbish, who looks after the kids, all the actual negotiations that take place in family life. So those two things combined, I think, got me interested in gender and in thinking about women, thinking about men, and particularly beginning to think about men in my place of work as clients.
Okay, and you, because often when we and we talked about this yesterday after your presentation on gender and how it's often when we talk about gender, we talk about women, particularly if you might go and do gender studies at university, but we often forget about the men in that relationship.
Yeah, I think that is true. But again, one of my fears is that we don't have a knee-jerk response and we don't go down a sort of a strong father's rights and men's rights view that becomes antagonistic towards women and towards the progress that's been made in the way that women are treated in society, the way they're viewed, the opportunities that have been made available. What I wouldn't want to see is a huge backlash, I guess, is the common term that's used. I think it's important to understand gender as being about sets of relations. So improvements in the health of women should help improve the health of men, and vice versa. If we work towards improving the health of men in a true sort of holistic sense, then we also ought to be improving the health of women and children as well.
A 94.9.
This is Well, Well, Well on Joy 94.9 with Tex from the Health Promotion Program at the Victorian AIDS Council Gay Men's Health Centre.
Joy 94.9.
And if you've just joined us, we're listening to a pre-recorded interview with Stephen Robertson from the Centre for Men's Health at Leeds Metropolitan University here on Joy 94.9.
Now, you recently presented a work in progress on the concept of masculinity and masculinities at the Australian Research Centre in Sex, Health and Society, but you're also going to be presenting at an Andrology Australia conference on men's engagement with health services, or whether they actually do engage. Now, this is probably becoming more of a popular issue, or an important issue to talk about in Australia, because we're currently developing our national men's health policy. And what are some of the challenges do you see when you're talking about that issue, not just about whether men are engaging or not, but how people are trying to tackle that problem?
I think there's two things wrapped up in that, really. One is what research tells us, and I guess the other is what's happening in practice. So I think in terms of what research tells us, that things are not as clear-cut as the popular view would have you believe. So the popular notion that men don't access services. And when we look at the research, that is, it's far too oversimplified a way of thinking about things. It's certainly the case that more women than men access GPs services. Do you call them GP services over here?
General practitioners, doctors, yeah.
Yeah.
General term.
That's certainly the case, and particularly in the years between sort of 16 years old to around about 60. That's definitely the case. But a lot of that is to do with routine screening that's more generally offered to women, cervical screening, breast cancer screening, but also reproductive health, so going along for the pill and other sort of reproductive services account for quite a large amount of those figures. When you look at things like inpatient services, actually more men than women use inpatient services. So it's not as straightforward as it seems in terms of the research evidence. There's one other study that it might be worth mentioning that was done a while ago in Glasgow that looked at access to GP services in five main condition types. So it split them into things like cardiovascular issues, respiratory issues, psychosocial issues. And what it found was that for the same level of symptom with any condition, the rates of accessing GP services were the same for men and women. So again, it's not as clear-cut as men not accessing services.
And I guess if there is that perception out there that, oh, men aren't accessing services or going to their GP, then people are probably thinking, oh, well, they just don't care.
Yeah.
And it's not important, which is not the case.
Yeah, and you've hit on another very interesting issue about the notion of men not caring, men not taking responsibility for health. And again, I think this is more sort of popular stereotype than lived reality for an awful lot of men. What I found in some previous research that I did when I interviewed men is that there seems to be a situation where, on the one hand, they have to buy in to some extent to that popular stereotype that men aren't concerned about health and well-being, because health and well-being is a feminized issue. But on the other hand, there's also strong pressures in modern society that we are, as good citizens, seen to be caring about our health and well-being. So I coined this term, the don't care, should care dilemma that men face. And what I found when I've interviewed men, and what other studies have found since, is that this plays out in various ways in terms of service access. What I mean by that is that one of the things that men seem to have to do is to find ways to legitimate accessing services. And there's different ways that men have found to do that. Becoming a dad is one way. So there's a lot of interview narratives about men settling down in terms of leaving hedonistic behaviour behind, less drinking, less smoking, once they'd settled into fatherhood. Family history of particular illnesses is another way that men legitimate access. So one man in particular talked about his dad dying when he was very young of skin cancer, so he's always very vigilant in terms of skin cancers. If he thinks he's got an unusual mole, he'll always go and get it checked out. Other men spoke about similar things with rheumatoid arthritis in the family. They were more vigilant. Cardiovascular disease, quite a lot of the men were more vigilant. So there are ways that men legitimate accessing services.
And, I mean, just thinking about the work that we do at the Victorian AIDS Council Gay Men's Health Centre, we work predominantly with gay and bisexual men. And there may be a perception out there that gay men probably utilise services a lot more or generally healthier because there's been a push for them to go and get HIV testing and STI screening. And have you worked with gay men in your research?
Yeah, well, interestingly, that particular piece of research that I was just talking about, I deliberately had a subsample of gay men and a subsample of disabled men as part of that research. And rhetorically, what you're talking about was definitely the case. So the gay men didn't have the same issues about having to legitimate going along. They tended quite often to align themselves with a more feminine view of health and well-being. And that came across in interviews in terms of the quotes were typically things like, well, gay men care more about their health and well-being than straight men. But that said, the actual statistics don't necessarily bear that out in terms of gay men's drinking practices, drug-taking practices, you know, similar or even slightly higher rates than straight men. And I think what they tended to mean was they don't have the same struggle to access services. They don't have the same barrier around machoism to access services. And certainly most of the gay men that I spoke to were definitely involved in regular screening for sexual health.
Steve, I'm interested in the access issues of whether men, generally, whether they're gay or straight, have the ability to access services. Now, doctors tend not to be open late. There are, of course, 24-hour medical clinics, but they're very much a in-and-out sort of service. Are there any issues? I mean, have you looked at any? Is there any research about anything about men being able to get to a doctor? You know, now if men are working 9 to 5 and doctors are generally open 9 to 5, is there any problem with men getting to the doctor? I mean, yeah, some of them may want to go, but their workplace may not allow them to go.
Yeah. It's again, it's an interesting point. In terms of what research shows, there's not been a huge amount of evidence that that is the number one reason that stops men going along to doctors. There is some evidence, certainly the very last point you made about the workplace, there's certainly some evidence that men find it more difficult to ask for time out from work than women do, and possibly even some evidence that employers are more likely to frown on men asking for time out from work for health concerns than they are with women. I guess what it does do is it brings us to the second point that I was talking about before, which is the issue of what's happening out there in practice. So certainly in the UK, and I know for definite in Australia, because Australia is leading the way in finding innovative settings and ways to access men. So there's work, for example, in the UK being done in rugby grounds, football grounds, workplaces, and so forth. I guess in a way to circumvent two problems. One, the fact that GPs are often seen as feminised settings. And secondly, to circumvent the issue that you were talking about around difficulties in access because of the 9 to 5 work issue.
I think that is a challenge for people working in health promotion and also broader health services, that they've had to start thinking outside of the box. And I know I've got friends who work for mining companies and providing not just health services now, but actually looking at health promotion activities, raising awareness and trying to think creatively of how to get men involved, not just in screening and going to see a GP, but actually taking on health information as well.
Yeah, and even, as you've just said, actually doing activities. So I know there was a programme that happened in Australia quite a number of years ago now called the Gut Busters programme. I don't know if you remember this.
I remember the name, but I can't remember the activities.
Yeah, if I remember rightly, or certainly in the UK, it was translated into what was called the Waste Watchers programme. And what they did was they worked with men in workplaces to do actual physical exercise as well as information giving. And they pitted departments in workplaces against each other in terms of seeing who could get the best health outcomes over, say, a 10-week period with activity and shifting diet. So they'd measure things like waist size, body mass index. I think they probably even did blood pressure, things like that. And they did it as aggregate data. So they didn't look just at individual men and put individual men in competition against each other. They grouped together one department, so it was a collective reduction in waist size or a collective reduction in body mass index, which I think is better than picking on individual men. And that, it seems to work very well. Men like action-oriented programmes.
And I think those activities would be really important, because there could be the case where there may be a campaign to actually recruit men to screen or to test for a particular issue, but and the marker is just getting them through the door, and then we don't actually know what happens afterwards, or they're not given activities or actions to take on once they leave the health service.
Yeah, and I think, for me, I think an awful lot of the wider health issues that men experience aren't necessarily addressed by even successful programs that get men to go along to sort of MOT type checkups. So, for example, I'm thinking about difficulties in holding down relationships, you know, difficulties with violence. These sort of wider public health issues are not addressed by MOT style biomedically based programs, I don't think, very often.
Because I don't know if I read this in a study or it was part of an awareness week, but an issue such as depression, that for example, a guy will go to the GP and present with headaches or other physical issues, but it's actually because they want to discuss something around that they're feeling down and depressed.
Yeah, and this, it was very interesting. I was looking at some research to do with suicides in farmers only the other week, like you do in your spare time. And that was exactly what was found. There was no difference in accessing general practitioners in the run-up to the suicide between farmers and men in urban settings. But what they did find was that even more so in the farmers, they were accessing predominantly with physical symptoms, despite the fact that that might be a manifestation of a depression, or it might be the only way that they could legitimate access. If we're going back to talking about legitimating access, but they couldn't get around to talking about the actual depression itself. There's also another concern that depression scales are actually developed with what some people have called a feminine ruler. So the very development of depressions to measure scales to measure depression are feminized and don't capture how depression would manifest in men.
Joy 94.9.
Thank you for the inspiration while there's music in the movement. Going strong.
The Victorian Gay and Lesbian Rights Lobby proudly presents Stonewall.
40 years on.
69 was a riot. Bring together a who's who of the GLBTIQ communities in song, dance, drag and spoken word, followed by a night of riotous dancing with Lou Bennett, Rocco D'Amore, Kay Sara, Luke Gallagher and more.
Stonewall, 40 years on. 69 was a riot. At the Glasshouse Hotel, 51 Gibb Street, Collingwood. On Friday, the 26th of June from 8:30pm. Entry $20, $15 concession. Tickets at the door.
Gay Dads Victoria is a support and social group for guys interested in gay parenting or who want to learn and gain more insight into a range of topics such as co-parenting, fostering and surrogacy. Visit GayDadsAustralia.com, GayDadsAustralia.com for more information.
Are you born to be wild? Or just looking for a leisurely ride with like-minded bikers? Melbourne Motorcycle Tourers hold events for the gay and lesbian community like day and weekend rides, attend motorcycle events, and just get together to have some fun. Check out motorcycletourers.org.au and get your motor running.
Vic Bears is a social club for bears and their admirers. You don't need to be furry, just gay and masculine with a down-to-earth outlook. Want to know more? Visit vicbears.org.au.
Joy, 94.9. Tune in a couple of times and you'll be moving in.
Oh, yes, indeed. This is Joy 94.9. And you're with Tex tonight, flying solo with Travis pedalling the buttons. If you've just joined us, we're listening to a pre-recorded interview with Stephen Robertson. Now, he's from the Centre for Men's Health at Leeds Metropolitan University. Let's hear the last part of the interview.
We've, you know, looked at men and how, you know, health promotion organisations and services might attract men to go and get tested or screened or be more aware of their health. What else do you think we need to do to create that shift and that focus on men's health and by looking at, say, structures or legislation or the sort of bigger picture stuff?
Yeah, I think it's incredibly complex, and I don't think for one minute there are simple answers. I certainly think we need to give a lot more consideration to how we raise boys in the UK, Australia, and I guess the States and Canada are probably similar. If I take just one example from my health visiting days, I actually have received phone calls during my time as a health visitor from mums who were very distressed because they found their little 3-year-old boy playing with his sister's doll. Now, you know, when we're in a society where it's still seen as very negative or something odd and unusual about a boy caring for a doll, then we've got a long way to go. Because these, you know, helping boys as they're growing up to learn to care, I think is very, very significant. Whether and who is responsible for that, you know, whether the responsibility lies with parents, with schools, with wider society, with all of the above, is, I guess, probably a never-ending question. But I think those sort of gender concerns have to be addressed, really, if we're going to make progress around the wider issues.
Absolutely. And I guess it's a you know, for health professionals working with men to start looking at the broader issues and not just about using that the stereotypical idea of a man to actually draw men into a service, looking at that whole range of issues, as you said, around relationship issues and whether there's family violence or whether someone has a young boy who wants to look after dolls. So we need, as health professionals, maybe we need to start challenging that as well and get the ball rolling.
I think it probably, you need to take a step back even further than that in terms of the health professionals probably need to challenge themselves and their own views, because I think the reason a lot of health professionals are reluctant to engage in health work with men is because an awful lot of them are fairly comfortable with their own stereotypes of men and women and, you know, the roles that men and women ought to have in society. So I think it's perhaps got to begin at that point as well, you know, in health professionals training, getting health professionals themselves to challenge their own stereotypes and where those stereotypes might lead.
One of the things I'm really interested in is the training of doctors in on one hand and the amount of time in a consultation. Now, we encourage men to go and have sexual health tests, but we say to them, you have to ask the doctor for a sexual health test. So that doesn't mean just asking for a HIV test. It means asking for the broad spectrum of sexually transmitted infections.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any? Have you looked at any data, or is there any training as to how to encourage doctors to pick up on the signals? It might be the signals of suicide. It might be the signals of depression. You know, but then again, we're dealing with a health professional who has a very small allotted amount of time to actually see someone. How do they address the broad spectrum of not just the reason why the person has gone in?
Again, I think that is an incredibly complex question. I'm sure most GPs would love to have more time than they do for each consultation. And I know from colleagues who still work in the health service that the emphasis is often on very quick checks. So, you know, lots of tick box questionnaires that don't always pick up these wider issues. So I can't really help you much more with that, other than saying perhaps GPs should have more time. But then on the other hand, unless they've also had the training that we were just talking about in terms of challenging their own stereotypes, it would also then be a question of how well they used that extra time if they did have it. So again, the two probably need to go hand in hand.
Before we finish, I just wanted to touch on going back to the men's health policy. Do you have a men's health policy in the UK?
It's very interesting. I did a presentation not long ago looking at sort of men's health policy in Canada, the UK and Australia. We don't have a men's health policy in the UK. We've gone down a slightly different route where we have, in 2007, brought in what's called the gender duty. This is a part of national law now. And what it means is that all statutory organisations, so not just health but education and other statutory organisations, have to pay attention to gender in terms of assessing need, in terms of meeting that need, making services gender sensitive. So it's a much more what we would call a gender mainstreaming approach. The difficulties with that sometimes can be what you mentioned earlier, which is that gender gets conflated with women. So in its implementation, you find that a lot of people are talking about, well, how can we make these services more female friendly? What we have got in the UK to help sort of offset that is we have the Men's Health Forum nationally that have very good links into government. They also host the all-party parliamentary group on men's health. So they're well connected with government. And they help, or I think will help over time, ensure that men aren't forgotten in the way that the gender duty is implemented.
Well, the, our men's health policy is almost at the end of its consultancy stage, so it'd be interesting to see how it actually plays out once it's completed and actually implemented, and whether there is an implementation plan that goes along with it, because that's probably the most important part, how it's actually rolled out.
I think it will be absolutely key. The policy is one thing, but like you say, the implementation plan and how that's followed through and audited is quite a different thing.
This has been another Joy 94.9 podcast. Joy 94.9 is a gay and lesbian volunteer-based community radio station committed to providing a voice for the diverse GLBTI communities. You can support our work by becoming a member or making a donation. For details, go to joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.